My name is Trung Nguyen, 41 years old. I'm a former Army Ranger, 14 years law enforcement, spanning from a suburban department in Illinois to gold standard LAPD to Chicago PD. Spent the last five on Chicago SWAT. I retired, came out of retirement this year, and now working as a trainer for a suburban department in Illinois. I am the founder and owner and CEO of WeGoHome, a supplement apparel company.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of...
Thank you so much for coming on the show. One of your producers reached out and said, hey, there's this movie, this is interesting person that you might be interested in. Here we are. I got to watch the movie. So congratulations about, you know, having that be made.
Oh, appreciate that. You know, I was really hesitant to, because just the way I am, I don't feel like, you know, I don't want to be like, look at me, you know, or whatnot. But he's like, it's a story that you should be sharing, because it's going to inspire a lot of people. And I figured, why not, you know?
Yeah. You know, I have that question prepared much later on, like the look at me thing. And I can imagine you as a one of the guys, you know, like, you know, when you look at David Goggins, he's all over the social media and he's everywhere in everybody's face. And I can only imagine like the haters or the guys that serve with him going, oh my God, here we go. You know, like, and you just said it. You just said this whole, like, you feel very uncomfortable with the look at me thing. How do you think other guys, like your sort of your peers, feel about you getting selected to make a movie about yourself?
You know how life is. There's going to be those who hate, you know, I've got this quote from my good friend, my mentor. He's like, you know, they don't hate the lazy ones. They hate the great ones, you know? And to me, it's just like, it's part of business. It's part of just things, you know. There's going to be people who are going to be supportive of what you do. And there's going to be people who are not going to be supportive of what you do. Maybe because it's jealousy, maybe because it's envy and whatnot. But to me, I always believe in having like the racehorse mentality. You know, I don't pay attention to what's going on to my left, to my right. I have goals. I have visions, and I'm going to make sure that I see it through no matter what. So I don't let it bother me.
Mm. How did you get found to get this documentary made about you?
I guess he's been following me for a long time on Instagram. So he reached out because he followed Two Lamb, one of my good friends, Ronin Tactics. And he's like, hey man, I'm interested in, so I watched his first documentary, which is called Ranger. And it's funny, the guy that he did the documentary on served at the same time as me. And we both lost the same friends. It's crazy how that worked out. Like, you know, the people that that died knew him personally. And that same group of people who died, we served in the same platoon, same company, same squad. So it's just crazy how that worked. And I really enjoyed. And
the two that died in your story is Bremen Braga. Those aren't the same two that were in Ranger, the other film, was it?
It was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy how we our lives crossed in that you know, one moment over there in Ramadi, you know. But yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking chapter of your documentary. You know, and for everybody who's listening, if they're interested, you can find it on Amazon Prime. It's streaming right now. It's a riveting documentary that has, you know, you get a first like being in the front row seat of war with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a story of, you know, what we are capable of as a culture, right? As a Vietnamese culture. Like, you know, I came over here to America when I was three. We fled war-torn Vietnam, communist reign. And you know, we came here, and it's just, to me, I love America, right? A lot of people don't like America now. They might think it's not the greatest country. To me, it is the greatest country in the world because America gave me all the opportunities that I have today. All I had to do was give everything I had. It had nothing to do with the color of my skin. It had nothing to do with where I came from. It's how much effort am I willing to put forth to be successful? And they'll just reward you in return. So that's what I wanted the documentary to be about, to show us as a Asian Vietnamese culture of people fleeing such a country that it was like war torn, stricken with poverty, stricken with death, to seek life in another country. And there's many, many, many Vietnamese people who are so successful and so inspirational that made such an impact, living here in America. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. The United States is probably the one of the best countries to live in. I just got roasted on another podcast. I just talked about this with another guest on another podcast. I got roasted because the podcast was in Vietnamese, and I said, "I'm Vietnam Sung Lâm." It's a wonderful life, And that was like the thumbnail that this podcaster put on with my face, and I got thousands of comments going. Go live with the communists, and I think that nuance of conversation is being lost nowadays. And that's why, although you and I, our politics are probably, very different, but I welcome the nuanced conversations and figuring out what do we share? What do we share as people who are, we share the same homeland, our motherland. And we share, you and I, we share the common military background. And, somewhere along the line, you and I sort of had very different departing sort of directions in life. And I value whenever somebody can sit down with me and just have a conversation about life and about, our experiences, shared experiences, but they're very different. So thank you so much for being open to coming on.
To me, that's called being an adult, right? I respect your views. That's what makes America great, right? It's like, hey, you can believe whatever you want to believe, and I'm cool with that. I'm not gonna sit there and trying to jam my theories, my beliefs down your throat, right? Because like you said, we both ventured on to maybe different paths, but I respect you. You're an American just like me. You know what I mean? If war comes to our country, we're going to be fighting side by side. It's not going to be left. It's not going to be right. It's going to be America as a whole. And I think a lot of people forget that, right? It's okay if you're a Republican. It's okay if you're a liberal. It doesn't matter to me. I'm pro-America. Whatever is great for our country, I'm all for it. And that's it.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together, we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information. Now, you've been on the streets for a long time, patrolling, even growing up in Chicago. You got the beat, and I don't mean that, no pun intended. You have the beat of the community down. You understand, the feelings of sort of all of these people that don't come from, a little bit more affluent or educated side. Do you think that the state of policing in America will ever sort of get better in terms of the relationship between the police and community, people of color, people of disadvantage, impoverished? Do you think that relationship will get better in the future? Because right now, I think you mentioned in the documentary, all the money is being defunded and all, there's no support from a lot of the cities because of political pressures. But one day, do you think that these two sides are gonna kind of see eye to eye on things?
I grew up in the hood, And I'm kind of, when I was younger, I resented that, right? But as I got older and matured, I am thankful for all my struggles and everything that I went through, because it really opened up my eyes, because I got to see firsthand what it was. I grew around predominantly black people up in the uptown of Chicago. You know, I grew up around gangs, violence. There was drug selling, people getting killed, crackheads, you name it. I was surrounded because we were immigrants. We were placed in Section 8 homes. We didn't get fed with a silver spoon when we got here. We got put where we got put. And my mother worked two jobs, and she had to do what she had to do to support her family back home and us here. So I got to see that firsthand. And what I realize is it's about the upbringing, right? I mean, the people, the family there in that community, they come to resent the police because maybe they put away the baby daddy or the cousin or whatever. And I was out there, and those gangs of thugs, like, yeah, don't trust the police. F the police. They're the bad guys. All that stuff. When you are surrounded constantly with that type of message, you're gonna have resentment towards the officer, even though you don't might not know them. And I had that resentment in the beginning because that's what's been fed to me by the community, right? But if your family, if you have a strong structure of family who respects the law, who knows that law enforcement is there to help them, not harm them, and teach the children not to fear the police, but to welcome them and respect them, you're gonna have a different mindset and different thinking. I mean, I had kids like 4 years old when I used to work Chicago, down in the South Side, and they would give me the middle finger. They would say, "Excuse my language," I'm like, "Fuck the police." And this kid's 4 years old. Who do you think teaches him that? You know what I mean? It's so.
How do you think this will ever get better? You know, because I understand what you're going through. You know, I understand that programming and the messaging of these inner city families, but how do we get through this? And I think a lot of my friends in academia and in safe neighborhoods are not experiencing the same things that you're experiencing. You know, you're experiencing something of a reality that a 4-year-old is doing that to you. But at the same time, how do we bridge this? I mean, I'm talking about America as a whole, not you specifically, but
Yeah, for
how
sure.
does America as a whole bridge this divide?
I think as police, we can't have the us versus them mentality, right? Is there bad people out there? Absolutely. In those communities. Are there good people out there? Absolutely. There's families in these poverty-stricken neighborhoods that are trying to make ends meet, trying to have their kids go to school, trying to do the right thing, but they're being surrounded by all this crime and all these things. They kind of get mixed into the whole the situation, the community, right? As a police officer, I mean, if there's cops listening, rookies or whatever, even the senior guys, I would say do what that officer did for me when I was a teenager, right? That really changed my perspective and changed my views of the police and me wanting to be the police. Get out of your squad car. Go talk to the community. Like, really, don't stay on your phones. Don't just drive around and just oh yeah, I'm just gonna answer my call. Don't forget why you raise your right hand. It's to protect and to serve, right? And to make a difference in those communities. That's why I wanted to be a cop,
But
because
don't you think some of the guys are probably terrified of getting into that community and getting out of their squad car and, you know, actually creating, building trust and a relationship? That's
I would say,
real problem, right?
I would say, then you're in the wrong profession. You're a civil servant, right? That's first and foremost. You're here to serve the community. You're here to make a difference. And that cop, when I was playing basketball on the corner when I was like 12 years old, he caught out his freaking vehicle. He's like, "Hey, I'm Officer such and such. This is the neighborhood I patrol. This is my business card. You guys shouldn't be staying out this late because there's a lot of shootings. Last time there was a homicide." And he was really like
Caring.
talking to us and caring. And I was like, "Oh my God, like this guy don't even know me, and he's doing all this." And that's really what made me wanted to become a cop. So when I took that and I applied it when I was a police officer to these kids, not every cop is going to do what I do. Not every cop is going to do what he do. But the ones that are willing to do that and put forth the effort, that's how you're going to make the change in the community. Step out, talk to your neighbors, make friends with grandma. Go and talk to that kid on the corner. It's not going to hurt.
Are those, I mean, you sound like a good cop. I mean, just, I would say what it is. You sound like a good cop who has a really good understanding of the philosophical ways to kind of improve the relationship. How many of your percentage wise guys on the force, guys on the teams with you have that same sort of perspective?
I was obviously, it's not going to be everybody, right? Everybody's cut from a different cloth. Everybody's going to have the way they think different. Being around a bunch of alphas,
yeah,
it's just everybody has their way of policing. I can't come up there as much as I want to come up to that 20-year old timer. Like, hey, you look kind of sloppy. You need to get in some shape. You need to thin down. You need to work on your tactics. Go out there, and they're like, get out of here, kid. Who are you? You know, it comes down to ego, right?
Yeah.
If you have that ego, if your ego is bigger than who you are or what you think you can do for the community, then you're lost. You're not doing what you raise your right hand to do. And I always tell people, don't forget the first day when you raised your right hand. When you're all bright eyed, bushy, and you're like, oh man, I'm going to be the police. I'm going to make a difference. Don't forget, a lot of cops forget that over the years. They get jaded. They get, you know, hated on so much by maybe the politicians, the media, that they come to a point where they get salty, right? You see that in the Marine Corps. It's like that everywhere.
Yeah. Everywhere.
Be that difference. Realize like, hey, I might not change the entire department. I might not change the entire nation of policing, but when I don my uniform, when I go out there and I patrol my beat on my time, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to make a difference with the people that I interact with. And if more cops think that way and more cops do that, you're going to affect change where you can, which is what is in front of you, what you can control. I can't control the nation of policing as much as I want to. I can't. I can only control myself. If I can instill that message and if I can be a positive person on the department, maybe another rookie that just came in and he sees what I'm doing. He's like, oh, I like what Officer Wynn's doing. I like what Wynn's doing. I think I'm going to do what he's doing. You know what I mean? So.
You know, another angle to all this too that you brought up in your documentary is when you come back as a young soldier, young Marine from war, and you are sort of dealing with all this untreated PTSD and all of this like wartime, you know, that's anchoring you to think a certain way. And a lot of these guys go right into the police force, untreated or semi-treated. I'm sure you probably saw a lot of that too. And so that separation of that psychology, that healthy psychology is kind of gone. But I think that when they, and this is just me thinking sort of like out loud about like men coming back from war.
Yeah.
That if they're coming back untreated and then they're dealing with like a civilian, us versus them, and it's untreated, that's probably a narrative that's probably inside these police departments across the country, because a feeder system of the police force is coming from the military. So did you see a lot of that? Was it something that was an issue?
You know, well, I would say early 2000s war, you know, coming back and talking about trauma or seeking help was taboo, right?
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to be the tough, oh, you're a ranger, you know, like what you're seeing people die, killing people, what you're supposed to be okay with that, you know? But a lot of guys aren't, and there wasn't really that much resources out there in the beginning to help these veterans combat that, right? But now I would say it's a lot more resources for it's okay to get to in a group and talk about that and seek help, right? To answer your question about that, in the beginning, you know, I was lucky enough that the people that I were able to work with, I did not see that. I worked with some badass veterans, guys who came from the Navy, guys who came from the Marines, who are now outstanding police officers. You know, is there officers out there that are like that? Probably, absolutely. But for me personally, I've never ran into those type of officers when I worked the beat or when I was on SWAT or anything like that.
And you know, for those who have not seen your documentary, obviously, I want to know how you got out of, you know, I've watched it, but how did you get out of the depression and the PTSD and that crazy 1 year of drinking and being lost.
Yeah. God, I believe in God. You know, I wasn't a raised Christian. I was raised Buddhist. You know, my mother is a Buddhist. So we grew up in a Buddhist household, but, it's through God that I found this escape and really steered me back on the right course, you know, and I had no one to talk to at that year when I got out. My mom didn't understand, my little brother, nobody understood what I was going through. No one did. You know, I went to college. No one, you know, I was surrounded by kids who were in their bubble. They don't know what's going on. So me personally, when I started going to church and you know, reading the Bible and finding my faith, that's what really helped me dig myself out of there. I got God to thank for that. He saved my life many times.
Did you get, I mean, that initial step into a church or that initial step to reach out to God?
Yeah.
What light bulb went off in your mind to reach out, or was it something that was an outside force that reached into you?
Man, that's a good question. I would say both, right? I started, something tugged in my heart and said, like, hey, you need to go to church. And you, I started going with my friends, and from there, I started listening to sermons and you know, going to, like, you know, these little group meetups. Through that and prayer, it really, both ways, it really did. I think God works in mysterious ways, and he pulled me out of it. He's like, no, I have bigger plans for you. You know, you're not gonna, you know, I thought of suicide before, you know, when I was around that year. It was really dark for me, and God had other plans for me. He's like, no, I have plans for you. So
yeah, I ask you this because I think a lot of people in the world are experiencing depression in ways that it's hard to get out of.
Yes.
And, you know, you can go see therapy, you can get medicated, you can try to figure all this stuff out. But, you know, an answer like I found God is so easy to say, especially if you have already gone through it, then it's easy because you already gone through it. But for anybody who's going through that right now, I mean, I've gone through depression and, you know, it was very difficult to get out of it sometimes. And it doesn't have a name. It doesn't have a feeling. You can't really describe it. You just know that you're lethargic all the time. You're just not wanting to do anything. You know, especially coming from a sort of a high energy past of going to war and being with these elite units, you know, it's so confusing to people who are going through depression and trying to get a lifeline to get out of it. And that's why I asked you, you know, but it, you know, it's hard to say when you say, you know, it worked both ways. You know, you reached out, God came in, and, you know,
I think that and purpose, once you lose purpose in life, that's when you start to deteriorate. Right. And I went through that personally, because like you said, I served in the 75th Ranger Regiment, you know, the Rangers, the guys who stormed D-Day on Omaha Beach, you know, the lineage of these badasses, right? I came from such a high level, purpose driven unit. Then when I got out, I had no purpose. And that's when I started falling into my depression, because there's nothing driving me forward in life. I had no purpose. And once you lose purpose in life, I think that's one of those things that will get you depressed. And when I found purpose again, and with the help of God, it really elevated me out of that depression state and had me wanting life, craving, being grateful. Like every morning now, when I wake up, I'm so grateful. The first thing I said, thank you, Lord, for another day on this earth, right? Because we're never promised the next day. As cliche as that sounds, the next day is never promised. And I live my life like that. And I live with gratitude, I live with purpose, and I live with faith. And with those three things together, it's really helped me combat depression, because I have a purpose, I have a vision that I have to see through, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. I think our modern era of leaving God, leaving church behind is, you know, I think that it's put our society on a different path and trajectory. I'm not one for any specific religion, but I think religion, if it's practiced on an internal level and you're not there to show up and compete with the Joneses for, you know, your Sunday best. I mean, I'm just talking about the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of politics in churches and
100%.
But if you could find a way to kind of like use it as a spiritual guide to live the best life that you can, I think it's a very good thing. And we moved away from that, I think, in the world, not just in the US.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, sir. It's just like, I'm not here to force my religion on anybody. Yeah. You know, I'm not that type. I'm not like, hey, you need to be a Christian. Hey, you need to do it. No. Hey, man, this is what I believe in, the faith that I believe in. I keep it tucked in personally. Unless, you know, we have this type of conversation, then I'll bring it up. But I'm not going to sit there and just start shoving it in people's faces, right? I think they should be able to find their own path, whatever religion they believe in, right? Religion, to me, it's a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing, it may be.
Yeah, the important thing is to stay open to all faiths. And I think the importance is to just follow one rule. Like if... Yeah. In John 16, in the New Testament, says God is love. That's all. Turn to all your neighbors, turn to whoever, and just be good to your neighbors. But see, that is the difficult part that I have with our U.S. military. You know, for me, you know, serving in the Marines and not knowing much when I joined at 17, it was like, you know, you get there and you're like, you're fighting on God's side. You know, we are on God's side. We're God's people, right? We're doing the right thing. But, you know, when you get out of that world and you get into the civilian world and then you finish college and you're surrounded by a lot of academic texts, I was an anthropology major and it opened up my eyes to religion and it opened up my eyes to different forms of beliefs and spirituality. I began to exist in a world where I'm like, wait a minute, wars, religion, all of it, money, it's all intertwined. Why can't we just be good to each other? But all of it is so incredibly complex. But then when I've separated myself long enough from the military, I often think about, I had family who also was in the military after I got out, and they were in Iraq and, you know, fought. And, you know, I often wondered, and we'd had conversations like, how can you still fight in wars when the evidence shows that we're going to war for many other reasons other than defending ourselves or being patriotic, right? Like, because if we got to defend ourselves, I'm all for it. We got to, you know, we got to protect ourselves. Yes, that's definitely when we need the military and the police. But some other things are debatable, which we won't get in here. But, you know, did you ever have to struggle with that idea that we sometimes go to war for different reasons other than what we think we're going to war for?
You know, honestly, I'm glad you brought that up. I think the last greatest generation was World War II veterans, right?
I agree.
We actually fought an enemy that was really evil, right?
Yeah, that's clearly defined. We agree. Yeah. We had to do that.
100%. That was necessary. Nowadays, are there political agendas behind like going to war? Absolutely. You know, when I first joined, because of September 11th, that's when I joined.
Yeah.
The two towers went down. You know, the United States has given me so much. I had pride, so I wanted to fight for my country. But then, you know, the whole thing about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which they didn't find any, you know, all the stuff. Then you realize like the bigger agenda, right? Like it's, of course, to me, I'm fighting for my brothers to my left and right, because I train with them, I sweat with them, I know their families. That's who I'm fighting for.
But it never fuck with you? Like you're like, wait a minute. They didn't find weapons of mass destruction. Did these things that like don't coexist with your philosophy, did it ever mess with you? Because I can't imagine like losing Baraga and Brem and then thinking about that years later going, wait a minute, they lost their lives for some other reason we thought they would be fighting for.
You know, that was the initial cause for us to do the invasion, right? Then after that first initial push, we met some resistance from the Iraqi government. But then after that, I mean, we won. Like they all left. They either left, got killed, or surrendered.
Yeah.
And then the following years are just freedom fighters from pouring over from different countries to Iraq to fight us. So when I was there in 2004, which was my first deployment to Mosul, we had a mission set. You know, we weren't like the regular army. We were like, okay, you got to go and patrol, just patrol until you get into contact, right? When we got there, we had we're a special operations unit who had intel on bomb making terrorists or people who are making certain things to kill our brothers and sisters from all the other branches. So we knew who we were going after. We were going after legitimate bad guys.
Yeah,
but those legitimate bad guys were there because we invaded Iraq. I think if we'd never got there to begin with, this would not really have happened, right? Same thing with Afghanistan. Think about that. Two decades of war in Afghanistan. I've lost friends over there too. Then we've all of a sudden just withdraw just the way we withdraw and gave all of our belt-fed guns, night vision. We left military equipment, billions of dollars to the Taliban, who we were fighting as our enemy.
I'm glad we're talking about this stuff.
It's crazy. Yeah. You know what? I'm pro-America, dude. I am. But if it's a pig, I'll call it a fucking pig. Even if it has makeup on, it's still a damn pig, right? Yep. Like, do I agree with what we did with the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war, looking back at it now? Absolutely not. But when I joined because of 9/11.
I joined right after the first Gulf War, and I felt the same patriotic feeling. It's like the U.S. gave my parents and so many other people in that first generation an opportunity. But then, man, when you start to like really dig into the history of the United States and colonialism, imperialism, all this stuff, it begins to inform you. And, you know, I'm glad that you kind of, you know, see it. And I'm glad that we're talking about it, because there's all these nuances from within the military, outside the military. But these things are like, wait a minute, what are we doing? What are we ultimately fighting for?
Money makes the world go round.
That's
right?
What I'm saying, man.
War is profitable.
But you know, back in the day, right? Like when you think about the Roman Empire, like we're going to go as the Roman Empire, we're going to go conquer land. We're going to go take gold. We're going to go convert your people into Romans, right? But that's clear. That's clear objectives, what they're doing. Like I'm not agreeing with that, but today it's cloaked in this, like the flag, the United States flag. And it's like patriotism.
Yep.
But that's not a cool conversation, because you know, if it was a flat out Roman conversation, the Romans did what they did. The Genghis Khan, they took troops and all over dominated. What are we parading as? You know, and that's the kind of questions that I have a problem with.
Yeah, it comes down to the politicians too, right? I mean, if you're coming into office and your yearly salary is $200,000 and you leave office and you're a multimillionaire.
There's something wrong with that.
What's going on? Like, of course, it's who can we bring into these wars so we can pocket each other's money, laundering money or whatever they're doing. Like I said, I'm with you on that. I don't think we should have invaded Afghanistan or Iraq, but you know, they used that with 9/11 as fuel to spark something, right? Because remember after September 11th, no matter if you're a liberal, no matter if you're a conservative,
everybody was down.
Everybody flew the American flag on their car. Everybody had like the American flag. Remember that era? Everybody flying little American flags everywhere. We were united. And I think they saw that and they were like, oh, wow. Okay, we're going to use this and we're going to take it and run with it, because Saddam has a bunch of oil or a bunch of things that we want. So let's go in there and dethrone him like they did the Gaddafi, right? So
this is what's crazy. I remember, so that was 2001, right? September 11, 2001, right? I remember one of my friends in the Marines, who's an officer at the time, and he said to me, around July 2001, they were on the base and everything that was green, camo green, you know, camouflage green, was starting to convert over to sand color. And this was July 2001. This is straight from the horse's mouth to my ears. Mm. This is not like I'm reading it online. This is what my, I've known that person all my life. Yeah. Came to me and said that. And he said, yeah, it's crazy. Because in July 2001, you could see the uniforms being issued. Everything was like converting over to sand color. Yeah, sand camouflage. Mm-hmm. Did 9/11 happen? So it's like, this is, was already in the works. Like we had to like deploy. We had to, I mean, in a business plan, you have capital, you have money. In order to like make more money, you have to like spend the money, right?
Yeah, so yeah,
this was like already thought about. And then, you know, you get that Iraq Gulf War stuff happening. And then after that, that does its own decade. And then you switch over to Afghanistan. It does a decade or two. Vietnam was the same way. They got the decade out of it. And so you begin to think after what you said, I love what you said about the greatest era, which is right after World War II, after that, it was like, you know, Eisenhower warned us all, like the industrial war machine, war complex is here. And we are living in it right now. And these are things that, you know, that aren't talked about in our Vietnamese community, even.
War is profitable. The most profitable business there is. And they're going to continue. It's an endless war. You know what I mean? We might be in peacetime right now, but, you know, just be prepared for some other conflict that we're going to be involved with, you know? So it's sad it is because, you know, like you said, it's not talked about a lot, but it's the ugly truth, the ugly side of America. Cause America, we're not just all sunshine, rainbows, the good guys, right? I believe we're one of the greatest countries in the world? Absolutely. But there's certain things in the machine, the cog in machine that needs to be changed.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, you know, that conversation. That's one of the things that I think we are definitely on the same team. We love America, and you know, but America is not perfect. And I think that talking about it is such a relief, you know, to hear that somebody who's gone through that extensive experience in war and in the military machine can come out to have, you know, free thinking. You know, you have a free thinking way of approach. Now, I want to go to Vietnam. Have you been to Vietnam?
Last time I was in Vietnam was when I was 9 years old. I have to go back. Yeah, it's been a long time. I saw my dad back
there. You ever think about going to Vietnam? Oh,
I want to. Like, Vietnam now is so crazy. My little brother was there for 6 months, and I was looking at his Instagram stories. Holy cow, has Vietnam changed?
Yeah.
It is now like one of the best tourist places to travel. I mean, it is insane. Capitalism is strong over there, man. The Vietnamese people, they love capitalism because you can tell there's just the crazy stuff over there.
You know, I shared with you in the beginning, like I went on this podcast, Sean Lay's podcast. He's a Vietnamese podcast, Vietnamese American podcaster. He was in the Navy for 20 years. So he's a recruiter, you know, logistics guy, I think. And so, you know, we're talking in Vietnamese and then I'm like, you know, Việt Nam Sương Lâm, you know, like, oh, it's such a fun place to, and then I started talking about low prices and then another podcast woman or YouTuber picked it up and she's like, how fucking dare this guy? And then it goes off in this echo chamber, right? And they're all speaking Vietnamese within, you know, the comments and everything like that. And then here you and I are both U.S. military veterans with, I don't know what your dad did in back in Vietnam, but my father, his family, his brothers were all in the South Vietnamese Republican Army. Yeah. My grandfather was killed by the communists in the early days of the Viet Minh. And it's like, these people are saying your parents didn't know how to teach you because we can reframe Vietnam as what you just said. Oh, it's, you know, capitalism is taking over. All of Vietnam is at another place in its history. And you talk about in your documentary, leaving Vietnam as a, you know, as a child and having to leave the communists. But today it's like, for me, it's like, okay, at what point do guys like you and me, we square up with our history and go like, all right, look, we get that communism was bad when you guys were growing up. And we get whatever problems that's happening in Vietnam right now. We understand, we can all recognize that. But at what point do guys like you and me say it's okay, we can go back and make friends with people in the homeland and talk about how wonderful the development is in Vietnam without being branded a communist or an ignorant person who has an. I've been to Vietnam for 25 years, going back and forth, some years four times. And I don't go back to party. I mean, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I don't do that anymore. And we grow as human beings as we're, you know, experiencing Vietnam's growth as well. Yeah. So,
no, I have family still over there. My uncles, my aunties, my cousins, my father, my half brother.
Oh, wow.
They're still over there, you know. The only one that came over here was my mother and my sisters, and my later on my brother. I do agree with you. Like back during the Vietnam War, we were displaced, right? My father was a businessman. The communists came down when they took over. They went into his house, stole gold from him, and he was super uber successful. So they came back and forth a couple of times to take his wealth, right? Wow. Is that bad? Absolutely.
That's absolutely horrific.
It's horrific. It's horrific what has happened to our country. The split, the lives lost, the displacement. My half brother died crossing the ocean, tried to come over to Vietnam on a boat of 80 people, and only two people survived, an 80-year-old woman and like a 4-year-old girl. The rest died from famine, starvation. We will never deny what happened to our country, but we need to kind of sit back and think like, hey man, Vietnam is now on a different, like you said, a different chapter.
Yeah.
Right. It's, are they still communists? Yes. But it's, we gotta be open. I'll never forget what happened, you know, for sure. 100%, but I'm not going to hold that grudge and not want to go back to my homeland to experience my culture, to see my brothers. I mean, to see my half brother, my father and my aunties and my uncle, they're living there. You know what I mean? They're thriving. Yeah. My brother has a successful cell phone business over there that's doing really well. My auntie has a coffee shop that's killing it. You know, it's like, it's not like they're communist is holding us down. Communist is like destroying us over there right now. They're thriving.
Yeah. I mean, I'll even put the statistic out. I think that if you think about 100 million people in Vietnam, and then you think about, let's say, 4 million people who are existing outside of Vietnam, I would say half of the 4 million who's existing in diaspora, a lot of us probably are struggling financially. We're probably struggling lifestyle-wise. So let's cut that down to 2 million people. 2 million people living, you know, a pretty decent life. I'm pretty sure that there is more than 2 million people in Vietnam living way above where we're living, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a numbers game. And I think that it's statistics. It's the development. So you can actually say, there's probably more people in Vietnam living a higher, better life than there are people in the diaspora living. Yeah. And we got to address that. We got to say, what's up with that?
Yeah. No, there's a good side. And obviously, there's always a good and a bad side. Like, you know, we talked about with America, right? Because Vietnam, a lot of our land, we sold to the Chinese. They're like, it's China owned. They go there, they buy our land, and they're doing what they're doing. We can't deny that either. Because we're with this, they're with the communist regime, right? And there's China has money. China goes over to Vietnam and they buy plots of our land to build whatever resource wherever they're doing. And the people who sell that land, they're going to be rich because of that, right? Is it the right thing to do? No, I don't think we should sell our land to the Chinese. You know, but
yeah, it's such a. Man, it's Vietnam's history is going to be it's a complex and a rich history of all of these things happening. And I think Vietnam playing sort of right in the middle of being, you know, in the middle between China and the U.S. is a very tricky place to be, too.
Yeah. Vietnam is thriving right now. If you notice a lot of the clothing, it's made in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Vietnam is the new China.
Yeah.
A lot of manufacturers are happening in Vietnam. Lululemon makes clothes for, you know, Vietnam makes clothes for Lululemon. Vietnam makes clothes for a bunch of these brand names out there. So
no, and then these chip companies, all of these like Intel and Nike, all of these big corporations, you know, have been doing business with Vietnam for very many years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's unfortunate that our first generation sometimes, can't really, but you know, the crazy thing about this whole experience for me in the last few years is like, The echo chambers for the Gen Z, millennial, Vietnamese Americans happening on social media, on certain platforms, is really a vacuum. And then you step off and you go to Sean Lay's podcast and you read the comments in Vietnamese. It's another like world. And then you go off into Vietnam's social media world and you see the participation or the age demographic. Everybody is fragmented. And obviously there's people like me who can, I'll traverse in different worlds. But for the most part, like people who were like going off on me in that world, the Vietnamese American speaking, Vietnamese only world, they didn't come over to my world. They didn't come over to my YouTube channel or social media, and there's no crossover. So what I realize is that we are very fragmented because of language, because of political ideology, because of how we feel about our homeland. All of these things do not, I mean, it's a good and a bad thing. The bad thing is, or the good thing is, because they're not all like together, different things can exist and grow on their own. But also because we're not as like tightly knit, we can't propel the culture forward or help each other out in sort of like unity, because it's just so fragmented.
I would, like I stated, and this is the last time I said, we'll never forget what happened in Vietnam, right? The suffering. And I think that's what it is. The people who went through that, it has scarred them so much
For life.
for life. And they built this hatred with, the North Vietnamese, the communists. Like, no matter what you say, they'll never forget that. They're holding on to it. The brothers and sisters, the cousins, the husbands, or whatever they lost over there. They hold that. I'm not going to take that away for those Vietnamese
I will
people.
always honor that.
I
Always
will always honor that.
honor it. Yeah.
But I think as a human being, as a person, you have to be open-minded. You have to understand, like, hey, it's okay for me to think this way because of my experience, but why is he or she thinking this way? What's making him and her have a different mind and perspective than me? If I think if we all as just human beings are able just to be more open to each other and kind of be like, okay, I can see where you're coming from with that. You know what I mean? I think it's only going to help you grow as a person and evolve as a person, right? And that's big to me. I'm all about evolution. I want to be better than I was yesterday. And how am I going to be able to do that if I keep my mind closed?
And the irony of this all is 70% of the population of Vietnam is under, well, I don't know, 35, 38 or whatever. They don't even register that we had a war-torn past, because obviously the government probably, represses that information. Oh, I don't know, but they don't. You don't feel that when you go to Vietnam. It's just a place where, everybody's Vietnamese. Everybody who shows up, you're either a diaspora from out of, or you left 10 years ago and you come back, and it's. But we're all Vietnamese, and that's the
It's
hard part to.
a part of history, and people move on. Like you said,
Why
good.
did your dad stay back?
My dad had family. He was like the head of the household out there, so he couldn't leave his mom and his brothers and stuff like that. So he sacrificed and stayed back, and he told my mom, "Make sure you raise him to be a good kid."
That was
And
it, like peace.
he gave my mom money as much as he could, and you know what I mean. And just, yeah.
That is heartbreaking, man. And do you ever, I mean, did you keep in touch with him all those years?
I lost touch in touch with him last time I saw him when I was 9. But after that, I had a resentment with him for a long time, because I was like, why aren't you here in America with us? I grew up fatherless, and it's just like it was different. It's something I craved as a young man, as a teenager, but I didn't know any better. But like I said, as I grew older and I became wiser, and I understand now, I understand what he's going through. And I right now he's 85, and he
Wow.
has, yeah, he's diabetic and he's not doing very well. So I'm gonna make a trip back home to see him before he dies. Because I know for a while when I was younger, I was like, I'll never want to see him again. I don't care if he dies. I don't want to contact him. But
Yeah.
now
Life changes.
life changes. Like you evolve, right? I'm a man now. I'm like, no, I want to see my father for one last time before he dies. So at least I don't have regrets. of never really having a man-to-man conversation with him at a later age of my life, later time of my life, in my life.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for opening up and sharing and having such a warm conversation with me, because it, you know, I always aim for that. I'm not a confrontational, you know, conversationalist. I don't like to go on any attacks, but I think, you know, it's always scary for me to sit down with, you know, guys that we share experiences, and then we kind of like we split apart in sort of our political ideologies. And but it's always something that I look forward to be able to sit and have these kinds of conversations, because they're important. If you and I could show our community that we could sit down together and have differences in the way we see things, and you know, and maybe the next conversation we go a little harder, you know, and then we could play around with each other. And but as long as we create this sort of trust and build these relationships between you, me, Tulum, Viet Dinh, all the conservative side, Sean Lay, you know, and I obviously come with a huge contingent of liberals and progressives. And I want us all to kind of be able to converse with each other and find common ground instead of divisive ways or a divisive conversation.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have nothing against your political views. You know what I mean? I respect what you think and how you want to live your life. It's called being an adult.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, right? Just respect each other. We're human beings. We're striving to be better and provide for our families and do good things. And as long as we continue to do good things, doesn't matter if you're a liberal or a conservative, that's all that we can do. You know, I mean, make the changes where you can make the changes.
Yeah.
You know, well, and that's what I live by.
I hope the next time this is what I hope. When you go to Vietnam, and I think you should go as soon as you can, because you just said your father's a diabetic, and that could, there's all kinds of complications that at 85, I'm a diabetic, so that's why I'm speaking from experience. Go as soon as you can. And then when you come home, hit me up, and then I would love to get your thoughts about Vietnam when you come home.
Absolutely, sir. It would be my pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Jung.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Phat.